and welcome to Worlds Apart. From the medieval crusades to recover the Holy Land, to the militarized efforts to impose democracy, Western positioning vis-a-vis other peoples historically has long been messianic in word and exploitative in action. As the rest of the world rises to claim its own destiny and its own ways of being and governing, where does it leave the self-proclaimed global leader? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Chandran Nair, founder of the Global Institute for Tomorrow. Mr. Nair, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Now, what I find very interesting about your take on things is that you approach colonization and racism not only as historical, but also as psychological phenomena. And your case is essentially is that they may shift forms, but they remain very persistent. And I've heard you claim in another interview that this need to feel superior or supremacist is so ingrained in the Western psyche that it's almost a primary way of engaging with the world, although perhaps without fully recognizing and acknowledging it. Can you give some examples? What stands out the most to you in this regard?
Well, thank you for having me. And before I just answer that question, let me try and just qualify a couple of things, because I think it's important that, you know, my views and the narrative we're having here is not seen as anti-Western. This is important because then people conflate the arguments, et cetera. So mine is a non-Western worldview. It doesn't mean I'm anti-Western. The second point is that as we talk about these examples as well, it should be understood, and I've said this repeatedly and written about it, that doesn't mean that the non-Western world is perfect or that it also is not subject to its own sort of failings, etc. So, you know, in my book, Dismantling Global White Privilege, I essentially spoke about nine spheres of globalization, which are essentially interwoven in terms of the need and the desire to preserve Western hegemony. And it was a natural progression from the decolonization, which involved, you know, taking the boots off the ground to seeking still to maintain control of the world. One thing I discuss in the book, one sphere, is both the geopolitical side, that white privilege allows for criminality to happen under the disguise of democracy. And Gaza is the best example of a free pass because it's white privilege. It's the United States, the European allies, and Israel committing a crime, a genocide by all definitions, but still being able to get away with it in the global media. That's why privilege. That's that sense of superiority that we could argue the case that we have different superior intentions, etc., to masquerade the true intentions, which is economic hegemony.
Can I ask you about it? Because I agree with you. I think it's all about, you know, being entitled to preach, but taking exemptions when it comes to practicing. You are not subject to the very same rules that you seek to impose on others. Now, I think the American state, the American mentality was born out of this messianic and colonizing drive of the early settlers. So I think to some extent it's natural that this divinely ordained mentality would be ingrained within the American psyche. But what I cannot understand is why the rest of the world bought into it so much, because the American state building experiment is very unique. It's structurally inapplicable to other nations. And yet, for many years, it was widely assumed, including in this country, in Russia, that the West, by definition, knows what's best for the rest. How do you explain this?
The key point here is that it's poorly understood what 500 years of colonization does to the mind. I was a subject of that too. I was brought up watching Western movies from Hollywood depicting the Native American, the original people, as savages. If you watch those movies 10 times and then you see John Wayne, you begin to feel as a young person, oh yeah, the savages are the Indians, etc. So the capture is total. I talk about this in terms of literature. I was living in Southeast Asia, and I was being forced to read Shakespeare, no other literature from anywhere else. So you are ingrained in believing that there's a superior culture, yours is inferior, and many African writers have also mentioned this capture of the mind. So the rest of the world didn't simply buy into it. They thought there was no alternative. What has happened in the last 10 years in particular is that now there is a realization that system is essentially flawed, it's exploitative and extractive, and it seeks to maintain itself so that it continues to be the economic hegemony of our times. So when you say the rest of the world all bought it, they didn't buy it willingly. It was essentially part of how the world the modern world was created, supposedly operated. And I do say that our elites, most in the developing world, etc., were essentially subject to this capture of the mind. So they often have said, we want you out, but my God, we want to be like you. So they went to the Oxfords and Cambridges, they went to the Harvards, etc., came back, the same stormtroopers. With that inferiority complex deeply ingrained in them about following the West. Mm-hmm. And of course, that Western power, particularly the United States power, was reinforced with the threat of violence, the violence both in terms of military aggression and the violence of financial power to destroy your country. So that's what's happened. But that is changing, and the country that stood up to it is China. So China has stood up. It can't be bullied and said, we have a different civilization. In fact, we have a civilization. We're not some recent creation of market forces, etc. And we're going to think about it differently. And that's what the rest of the world is also looking at carefully. So in one way, you could say the current administration in the U.S., no names mentioned, has done the world a great service by taking the mask off and therefore helping others to also decolonize their minds.
Well, I think this is perhaps a long process, and it has begun, as far as I'm concerned, long before Trump. I think Trump is a symptom of the process rather than
extreme version, yeah.
But can I ask you something about this process of conditioning, if not grooming, leaders to idealize Western ways or Western worldview, and simultaneously, because those things come hand in hand, simultaneously devalue their own national and cultural authenticity. I wonder, how do you reverse that in practical ways? How do you make people see and cultivate, you know, the green grass on their own side?
Well, there's two elements to it. The one is the mind. I think Black leaders like Malcolm X, Nkrumah and Nyerere and all wrote about this. I mean, Malcolm X in particular talked about the rejection of the straightening of the hair, the lightening of the skin, all of those. So that's a psychological side, not a sort of superficial sort of attachment to just identity, but essentially a way of rethinking who you are and understanding your history. So there is a great element of rethinking who you are, capturing your identity and feeling the sense that you belong to a wider world, not necessarily becoming simply nationalistic or ethnically proud in a naive way. The other one, which is the more difficult process, is essentially also dismantling the institutions that were created to keep you captive, to which our elites then bought in. And once they bought in, they became economically chief beneficiaries of the system. They were not going to give up that power either. So there is a whole process of decolonizing the institutions as well. That will take time, but I believe it's faster than we thought. But that is work that we have to do in our countries, and it's unique to each country, but it's also about narratives. And that's why, you know, but programs like yours and others, I always emphasize, we should not be demonizing necessarily the West. We know what happened. That is very clear. Now we need to be looking at how do we actually do the work that we need to do, and critically examining the root causes of the entrenchment and the actions we need to take to to do it differently. And now we're seeing in the world, we're looking at the institutions of de-dollarization, the whole monetary system, and even what is market economics and how do we actually develop and define development, progress, prosperity, all of those things.
And on the point of not demonizing the West, both you and I, we are having this conversation in English, and I suppose, at least for me, it's not my mother tongue.
It's not mine either, but yeah, but we are all colonized in that sense.
I don't take it as a colonization because it opened up the world for me, not only the Western world, but also I can engage with people like yourself using this lingua franca. But again, I'm using that as a tool, not feeling psychologically or, you know, spiritually binded to the West and not discarding it altogether, because there are many amazing things about Western thought, about Western technology, about Western social relations, etc. But it's about the word that you're using a lot, equity, recognizing a human in me and recognizing a human in you, whereas I think one of the biggest problems in the Western mentality right now is that they don't recognize humans in themselves. And as a result of that, they don't see that the rest of the world is also alive, that we actually are, you know, living beings and that we have that our own history, our own traumas, you know, our own, you know, imagination, our own creativity. How do you think we can change the world? How do you think we can reorient the West to see that there's humanity residing in the rest of the world?
I think, and I think you'll agree with me, it's, and because we are on a, you know, in a short interaction here, it would be harsh to say that the entire West has suffered from a complete loss of humanity. I think the political West has put itself in a difficult position, particularly in terms of its support for, you know, continuing wars, et cetera. So I think that is important to recognize. How we need to do it is, I think, requires a lot of work in terms of around the world. I think the political West will find it difficult to accept and suffers a great anxiety in terms of going through what I call the last phases of the decolonization process. The decolonization on a scale started to take place about 60, 70 years ago, the decolonization of Africa, Asia, et cetera. But the institutions of the new colonization were then created. And now we are seeing the final unraveling of that system. That will cause pain around the world. The question is, what does my country do to essentially now be part of doing that differently? And I will tell you that in my view, the most important thing is to recognize that we have been too subservient for too long. Our leaders have been too subservient. You could argue that even that, you know, when you're smaller, medium-sized countries, you don't have much power. But what has begun to happen is confidence in a new architecture. And that doesn't mean just taking sides with China, Russia, and being anti-American, etc. But confidence, as we've already discussed, in a multipolar world. And that work is very difficult, and it requires our leaders to step up.
We have to take a very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
For 20 years, we've broken all the rules you've invented.
You're watching RT.
Antum tushahiduna kanat RT.
Están viendo RT.
Vous regardez RT.
Here's the today.
We were brainwashing your citizens. You accused us of running troll factories. You screamed that we buy off bloggers and celebrities. Made Trump great, and then made him great again.
Russia today is capable of conducting information war.
We know that RT possesses cyber capabilities.
To ban Russia today because of the nature of propaganda.
Get in their bullhorn.
Are we a propaganda bullhorn? Well, it's time to say sorry. Sorry not everyone has heard us yet. We're always working on making our bullhorn louder.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Chandran Nair, founder of the Global Institute for Tomorrow. Now, Mr. Nair, prosperity has long been one of the West's key attractions, and what we are increasingly seeing in Western nations is their wealth and lifestyle advantage being squandered because of the arrogant or wasteful policies. Many Western nations are running huge deficits, their public infrastructure is getting decrepit. Do you think the Western model, the Western appeal, will still be as strong and attractive if it loses the veneer of affluence?
I think the human desire to be better off, to ape what is seen as progress, is something that is, you could say, almost innate in human beings. But human beings also understand when they are better informed that there are different alternatives and that there are particular circumstances will define that. So I would say that it's not because what's happening in the West that the aspiration for what is a better life and what is prosperity and what can be attained will be shaped. It'll be shaped by the constraints. Mm-hmm. And that is very clear. So, you know, I have my first book written that, you know, the Asia-Pacific region, or what we call Asia, might have 5.5 to 6 billion people by 2060. We'd be the most populous part of the region. I've argued that, you know, if you're conscious of the law of physics and limits, etc., there is no way that 5 to 6 billion Asians can or should aspire to live like Europeans and Americans. So you have to explain that. Mm-hmm. I think that narrative is now becoming very clear that we can't have everything, but we do have basic rights. And those rights are essentially the rights to, as a human being, in whichever part of the world, and it's the obligation of the state to essentially deliver on the ability for people to live with dignity without the drudgery of life. But if the geopolitical tensions continue to be framed around sort of colonial East India Company sort of market economics of two centuries ago, then we will continue to have these struggles. Mm-hmm. I do believe that that change is beginning to happen as the existential threats converge. These are converted into political understandings and new leaders emerge. Mm-hmm. And that is what will define it, not what's happening in the West. In a way, I argue that it's kind of becomes irrelevant what happens in the United States or Europe. And we wish them all the best, but they are only 12-13% of the population. Our challenge is, how are we going to live in terms of the existential debt, the resource constraints, and how do we use technology responsibly without following the neoliberal economic suggestion that everyone can be rich?
You mentioned the word dignity, and I do want to ask about that, because I also think that on par with this drive to ape or copycat what's seen as progress, I think dignity is an intrinsic, very deep and to some extent spiritual human need. And contrast to that, a big part of the colonizing or supremacist ethos is humiliation as a mechanism, yes, as a structural mechanism of sort of lifting yourself up by pushing the other down. And we're seeing so much of it these days in the public interactions between the European and American leaders. It's almost become a ritual for Donald Trump to, you know, ridicule or humiliate his European allies, and for them to fawn to him in very grotesque and cringy ways. I wonder, how is it perceived in your part of the world, where I think dignity is one of the not only individual but also social values?
Yeah, so it is, but, you know, I'll come back to the point where we started, where we say the deep-rooted subservience to the West is something we shouldn't underestimate. So even recently, when the U.S. president turned up in my country, I'm originally from Malaysia, for the ASEAN meeting, people like me cringed at the way our leaders essentially fawned. It's deep-rooted, but most people don't understand. It's in their body language, everything they say. So that is something it's not understood. It will take time. I've written in my book, and I hope my Western friends will understand it. Don't think I'm being too unfair. But you can be a white person and walk into a place in Singapore, Jakarta, and you'll be treated differently. I mean, this is well known, right, throughout everywhere. So that is 400 years of colonization. It's not that white person's problem. But quite often it is also exploited because, you know, those are the things that are entrenched in the colonial system and how it was built. That is being deconstructed, but it will take time. So in our part of the world currently, I think there is, coming to your point, a recognition that, my God, these people we thought were superior because we were told and we were ingrained, and although we were oppressed, we thought they were superior. But my God, they are behaving so badly, and now they are essentially disabusing us of our facial recognition of what all of this is about. And that, I think, is the important thing. But we have to work on it very hard, not to hate, but to understand that we're all equal, actually. And to have equity, you first need to capture your own dignity and believe in it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I personally have traveled a lot around the West and in many Asian countries. And one of the things I admire the most in Asian societies is this balance between the respect, authentic, not forced respect for the collective norms, and individuality. And I think it's ultimately at the core of any national project. How do you navigate and accommodate both the social needs and rights and the individual needs and rights, and how you do it in the most effective way? Now, the West and the Americans in particular have historically put a lot of emphasis on the individuality at the expense of the common good. And I want to ask you whether you think that this current state and the style, the cringy style of the Western politics, is a direct result of that. Is Trump and the field he constellates around himself, including in Malaysia, an aberration, or is it a direct evolution of the Western political thought?
I think it's an aberration. I think it is the power of that individualistic sort of mentality, but it's also clearly a behavior that is born out of the sense of exceptionalism, you know, the exceptionalism that we are special. And you hit on a very important point talking about behaviors. And when I talk to many of my friends from different parts of the world, the differences, right? And again, one has to be careful not to overgeneralize. But the sense, the way we, the societies here are structured, is essentially one of collective rather than the individual. The United States is probably the prime example of where the individual is king and the collective is subservient. And we saw this during COVID, that in poorer countries in Asia, without all of that science and the technology and the infrastructure, the ability to abide by the collective welfare allowed a lot to be done. But I would also say that those strengths that we have are also under threat. And it's under threat from what I call the global assault of modernity. And in most parts of the world, modernity is equated with westernization. That's the struggle of our times. And that's essentially the ideological struggle. Whether you want to call it democracy and imposing it, is essentially about saying you need to be like us, Western. And if you're like us, then you're modern. If you're not, you're backward. The main point I will make is there's a struggle in the West today is that the inability to understand that the individual has to be subservient to the collective.
Well, I may disagree with you with the choice of word here. I don't think it's about subservience. It's about understanding the benefits of the partnership, because I just came back from China, and the most impressive, the most remarkable thing there is not even the level of development, but how clean, safe, smoothly operated everything is, and people don't feel the need to vandalize public infrastructure. They don't feel the need to aggress.
Sure, but that's the point I'm trying to make. because they believe in the collective welfare, not their own. And because, and this is uncomfortable, because the consequences for not abiding by the collective welfare is serious. It's both in terms of ostracization, but also in terms of the rule of law. So that's what I mean by, you know, the individual is subservient to the welfare of the collective, and therefore they preserve their individual dignity through the collective. And I'll give one more example, which is Japan. So Japan is very unique. It's a capitalist society. It's an ally of the United States. But Japan is, as you wanted to talk about cleanliness, etc., Japan has the best toilets in the world. If anyone's been to Japan, they know it. The trains are spotless. No one uses a mobile phone on the train. Why? Because the individual understands the social contract with the collective. So the collective is that we do not disturb anybody else. So as an individual, I will essentially restrict or control my desire to indulge in whatever makes me feel good at this moment, because I would be imposing on the others. So that's what I mean by the individual has to remain subservient to the collective. And that's why you have order. And when do you mention China? I just came back from China. I've been in and out of China hundreds of times. The last 30 years, I've been based in Hong Kong. And the Chinese model is simply that. There are rules. And because we are so large, and it's a large country, we can't have a free-for-all. The individual cannot impose their rights on others, and therefore there's a collective understanding. But it's also rooted in civilization. And I'm of Indian origin, but India doesn't have that at the moment, though it used to have it, because its political system is not able to enforce the consequences if you do not abide by the notion of the individual being subservient to the collective.
Well, it's a long political process, and it's a balance that any nation, any people have to consider by themselves, taking into account their own, you know, past, their own geographic and economic circumstances. It's a very difficult and deeply moral question to ponder as well. But I guess
it's a political question, though. But it's political order. I mean, as a woman, you can walk anywhere in most major cities in China any time of the night.
Absolutely. And I cannot do the same in London or New York at the moment, because it would be very, very dangerous
for me.
Well,
lots of parts. But what is the difference? It's a political system. And the political system is not about a party or whatever. It's actually the contract between the individual and the collective. And people want to just see it as, you know, simple ideology. It's not. It's much deeper than that. And that's really important to understand. And the same in Japan, though, and that the political system is different. But I would argue Japan is unique in its culture for always putting the collective before the individual. But sometimes people argue results in kind of boring, the Japanese boring businessman. But, you know, rather the order than the chaos.
Well, Mr. Nair, I think we can end on agreeing that we all are unique in our own ways, nationally or collectively. And we have to appreciate and make better use of it, rather than trying to outsource it to some, you know, seemingly benevolent authority across the ocean. Anyway, we have to leave it there. I greatly appreciate this conversation. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.